Good evening. Welcome to the third quarter 2022 wrap-up equity overview and Rambus Chartology. Obviously, I was going to do this in October, but one thing led to another, and instead I'm doing it in November. So we'll have another one in January. The organization this evening is I'm going to be having you come along with me through the charts on my desktop. So that'll be the video. We're going to review the markets. I want to go through some noteworthy trends that are happening in the financial markets that I think are important for you to be aware of and will have an impact in the next year. And then I want to talk, as I always do, about what do you do about all of this? Because I've covered that topic so many times before, I'm going to point you to some of the resources that we have on the website that can help you do that. And finally, of course, it's December, so the holiday season has begun. So, you know, I'm going to start talking about Christmas. Okay, so let me start. Visual Capitalist, which is a wonderful site that does a lot with infographics, just published something called All of the World's Money and Markets in One Visualization. And I think it's pretty interesting. So I wanted to go through it before we dive into how the markets have done in the third quarter and year to date. So interestingly enough, they start off with Bankman-Fried. I'm calling it Fried, not Freed. Bankman-Fried, his peak net worth. So one square equals $100 billion. So the notion of that guy being worth $100 billion. Well, actually, it's not a full square. So it said that his net worth on March 22nd was $26 billion, and today is worth $1 billion. It's only worth $1 billion if he hacked the money. Although FTX does have a billion in cash, but they have much more. You know, they have over a million creditors, so they have much more in liabilities. Okay. Then it shows sports teams, the entire crypto market, which now that's the November 2021 peak. So actually, I thought they're saying it's $760 billion today. I thought it was about half that today. But the peak, at the peak, it was almost $3 trillion. Then it's got Russia versus the Ukraine GDP. As you can see, Ukraine's GDP continues to shrink. The last time I looked, it was about their per capita income was about $3,000. Military spending, U.S. obviously outspending just about everybody else, but China catching up. Then currency markets, you see the U.S. is still the first biggest, the euro market area. Number two, which is why I think the big competition here for in the currency markets is U.S. versus the euro. Then it shows gold, how much is in jewelry, how much is in bars and coins, how much is at the central banks and others. And then you have the storage gold below ground reserves. I take the gold numbers with a grain of salt. I think the official statistics are not necessarily trustworthy. The world's billionaires have a collective net worth, they estimate, of $12.7 trillion. And you can see over here, this is the top five largest billionaires. Total billionaires, 2,668. Central bank balance sheets. So you see the Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, People's Bank of China, Bank of Japan. Now we get into the equity markets. So the S&P 500. And here's the top 10 companies in terms of market value. This is as of November 20th, 2022. So the market cap for the entire S&P is $36 trillion. And the 10 top 10 companies make up 25% of that amount. So this shows the U.S. and China GDP. There's a lot of funny business going on in these numbers. Real debate as to when China takes over in terms of the number one GDP, if it hasn't already. Clearly, given what's happening in China economically, it's shrinking back. So it wouldn't surprise me if the U.S. is still number one. The global money supply, and this is all currencies. And so what they're saying is that the global equivalent of M1 is almost 50 trillion, and then the broad M2 category is 82.6 trillion. Now we've got the stock markets. So the S&P, clearly the biggest one, but if you see the emerging markets as they securitize, the emerging and frontier markets and the other markets are getting bigger and bigger. Here's another way of looking at it. 25% the New York Stock Exchange, 18% the NASDAQ. So that's the big U.S. exchanges, and then it goes down from there. And these, you know, it's amazing to see the growth in the emerging and frontier markets and the others. So as you can tell, the global debt market is much bigger than the stock market. The global debt market is the, you know, sort of the mother of all markets. So we've got the non-financial corporates, the governments, financial sector, and households. And of course, the big problem globally is the relationship between the real assets and the amount of debt as the debt keeps growing. We talked about, and John Titus and I talked about money and markets today, the fact that the UK is slashing spending and increasing taxes, putting, you know, just making that slow burn squeeze even worse. But it was a real symptom that the debt growth model is over. And the UK is first, but it's coming to the rest of the G7. Okay, then we see global real estate, and the size of the global real estate tells you why there's so much effort to securitize all of it. The total value of the world's real estate is estimated here to be about 326 trillion, with almost 80% of that being residential. And then when in the megacities wrap up, we talk a lot about the coming securities or the happening, I shouldn't say it's coming, securitization of real estate. Then 35 trillion in agricultural land and 33 trillion in commercial. Global wealth is kind of an iffy statistic, given how much of this collects up lots of paper. What they're saying is the biggest pile of global wealth is in the United States. A lot of times you'll see allocations of where the billionaires are. So according to their calculations, North America first, Europe second, China third, then Asia Pacific. It's interesting how they group all of Europe in one block, but not Asia in one block. Anyway, India, Latin America, and Africa. Then you start to see how big the derivatives are. So BIS says that market value of derivatives is now 12.4 trillion. Sounds a little bit low to me. It's the notational value, which is 600 trillion. So, you know, that's the black box. How much of that? You know, how badly can that bring down the market? If the net value is 12 trillion, then it shouldn't bring it down when the equity markets, real assets and real estate and bond markets are much, much bigger than that. But, you know, again, it's a black box. Hard to get good information on it. What have they got here? 100 billion. Here's just a few of the things that can fit inside 100 billion square. Cost of Nord Stream 2 pipeline is $11 billion. TikTok's revenue is $4 billion. Lego revenue, $8 billion. Spending by candidates and PACs in the 2022 election, $17 billion. Ha! That's the official figure. That's not the real figure. Global spending on military drones, $12 billion. Berkshire Hathaway stake in Taiwan Semiconductor, $4 billion. Operating budget of Austin, Texas, $5 billion. FTX financial hole, $8 billion. I bet it's much bigger than that. Anyway, so a lot of sort of other interesting statistics, but let's see. So they show the changes between 2017 edition and the 2022 edition. So Apple market cap went from $807 billion to $2.3 trillion. Gives you a sense of the real inflation. Crypto from $173 billion to $760 billion. Remember, it peaked at almost $3 trillion. Fed balance sheet almost doubled. Stock market, $73 trillion to $95 trillion. Global debt, $215 trillion to $300. So again, the global debt we see is the sort of mother of all markets here. And that's why the debt growth model being over and the, you know, the congestion of trying to handle all the debt, particularly by the sovereign governments, is a very major issue. Okay, so that'll give you a sense of the sort of the global markets. And what we've tried to do in the wrap-ups is to walk through different themes about the markets so that you get a perspective, sort of a top-down framework on sort of between currency, equity, debt, sort of where the action is. Anyway, all the world's money and markets in one visualization for visual capitalists. The links will be in the notes. But great job. Every quarter we publish Rambus's blockbuster chartology, and Rambus is my vote for the best technical analyst I've ever worked with. And I like to look at charts because it shows me a lot about where the price has been. It's really the history of the price in pictures. There's a lot more you can do with technical analysis, but for purposes of communicating on the equity overviews every quarter, I'm really looking at where the price has been and what that might say. You know, other things about the chart that tell me where it's going. Rambus called the top to the sort of equity market bull in February 2022. And of course, it was a good call because we've seen nothing but markets go down. And what you'll see if you go through Rambus, he spends a lot of time on precious metals and gives a real warning sign that precious metals are from a technical standpoint, not strong at all. And then he questions the future of the bull market and stock market. You know, he's basically calling a baron in the equity markets, talking about the impact of higher interest rates. And because he ends at sort of the end of the third quarter, beginning of October, I won't go too into it deeply. But basically what he's saying is, you know, everything looks weak. And that's exactly right. If you look at the Building Wealth web presentation, so remember, every wrap-up comes with a web presentation, and it's got a financial market section where we go through all the charts. But you'll see that the U.S. dollar had an unbelievably strong run between the beginning of the year and the end of the third quarter. Now, it's traded off, so if you look at it at today, it's back down to about 106. So let me just change this to year to date. And you'll see incredibly strong run into the end of the quarter here. So here we go. At September 30, it was 112, and it had run as high as 114. And now it's back down to 106. But still very high for the year. We started off the year at about 96. So that's an incredibly strong move in the currency market, and a lot of that you see a strong ruble and a strong U.S. dollar, and pretty much every other currency suffering against them. Interest rates, one of the things I keep talking about is the danger of inverted yield curve. When we started off the year, so I'm looking at the U.S. Department of the Treasury daily interest rates for, and this is the yield curve for treasuries from 1 month for the treasury bills. So 1 month, 2 month, 3 month, 4 month, 6 month, and a year for the treasury bills, and then the bonds out to 20 and 30 years. And you've got about a 200 basis point spread between the short end and the 30 year. But then if you come down to November 30th today, I'm recording on November 30th, you're looking at an inverted yield curve. So it's higher on the short end than it is on the long end. You're sort of peaking it. It runs up to about the 1 year, and then sort of flattens out and drops off a little. So it inverts after there. But clearly, when your 1 month is, you know, you've got 27 basis points higher in your 1 month, you're looking at an inverted yield. And it's not surprising that Powell came out today and said that the December bump in interest rates would be 50 points, not 75 basis points. So somebody's concerned about recession and deflation. And again, I keep bringing up the euro-dollar futures curve. You know, it falls off a cliff after January. So we'll see. But there are many signs flashing of recession coming. And if the market doesn't do it, austerity plans like the UK is doing it will certainly help. Okay, so commodities, we can see that the oil price, you know, wow, look at this. The oil price at one point by June was up over 120% for the year. So it's up 42% as of the end of the quarter. And of course, gold and silver not having fun at all, particularly the mining stocks, because energy prices are a very important component of mining. And as you can see from the commodities index, we're talking about higher inflation. Of course, as the Fed and the central banks keep raising interest rates, we're seeing more and more red ink coming into the fourth quarter. And of course, the Baltic Dry Index is down. And I covered that today in Money and Markets. It's still down. So not a great year for gold and silver, but it's important to understand. Here's a comparison chart. We're looking at gold down 3% for the year. This is using GLD ETF. Silver is caught up, and so it's down just a little bit more than gold. And this compares to the S&P, which closed today down 14%. And I wanted to show Treasuries, the long Treasury ETF, at down 30%. But what you can see is energy up 64% for the year. So I'm using the energy sector ETF just as a way of comparison. And of course, if you look at what's driving, for example, the S&P down, what's one of the biggest costs for all of those companies? It's energy prices. So we're watching some real pain as a result of higher energy prices. I saw one description. Martin Wolf had an interesting column in the Financial Times yesterday, and he described the fact that basically energy was four times higher this right now than it was in 2020. Let me see if I can find that quote. Okay, so as Martin Wolf talking about the OECD members, and I'm just quoting him, consider then what the report tells us about the economic situation. First, the energy crisis itself is truly huge. The share of OECD members' GDP spent on end use of energy is close to 18%, double what it was in 2020. So I'm sorry, it's not four times double. In Europe, the increases must be far bigger than this. The last time the ratio was this high was in the early 1980s during the oil shock caused by Saddam Hussein's invasion of Iran. Okay, so big increases in the cost of energy mean a lot of operations are gonna have, you know, tougher margins, harder fight to cover expenses. So it's a big shock to the system. Okay, so let's turn to equities. The third quarter, the S&P was down 16%. It closed today down about 14%. So not a lot of improvement. If you let's take a look at the chart for the full year. Again, what we see is the energy up here. It's up 64%, you know, arguing there is a bull market somewhere. And again, that's the energy select ETF. S&P down 14%. The VGK, the European ETF, down a little bit more than FXI is down. Let me just pull off VGK so we can see FXI. Sorry, that's the emerging markets, EEM. That's the emerging markets down 18%. And then the frontier markets down 23%. I've talked a lot this year about the dollar bear trap of those companies sort of choking on their dollar debt, and higher energy prices really puts them at a disadvantage, despite the fact that they should have higher growth than a lot of the companies represented, or the markets of the companies represented by the G7, whether in the VGK or the S&P. So expect the emerging markets and frontier markets to continue to struggle. So I think they're, you know, in for an even rougher time next year. In the first quarter, we did an analysis of the special acquisition corporations. So the subtitle was Investment Craze or Deep State Laundering. And we did this because I wanted to give an example of what was going on in the markets that, in my mind, is a wonderful case study to prove that the pandemic was absolutely an op. Because if you look at the going direct reset and things like the SPACs, I mean, it shows you the extent of the financial manipulations. Anyway, that's now out in hard copy, and it's turning out to be a surprisingly popular issue. So if you're interested in the equity markets, it's definitely a remarkable occurrence that happened in the equity markets over the last couple of years. And anyway, it's out in PDF form and hardback, so I recommend it to you. Okay, I want to talk about the top trends in the market this year, and many of these issues are covered on Money and Markets by John Titus and me, and I'm just pulling up the search bar for the Money and Markets commentaries. If you go to the homepage, you can often see, when you're not logged in, a sort of a short from Money and Markets, but you'll see the latest Money and Market reports up here, and you can click around. And they always come, if you go into one of the Money and Markets commentaries, with a link to the file that has all the story links of the stories we cover, as well as the charts received. And we have the theme. Then we also have Ask Catherine and lots of other links to things that we're referencing in either the Money and Markets or Ask Catherine. So all the links are there. And then plenty of discussion. There's always, so you can see, lots and lots of discussion. So Money and Markets is something you may absolutely want to plug into. Anyway, so let me talk about some of the trends that have been going on in the markets. And I'll just sort of hang and look at the website while we do this. The first thing I want to talk about is the debt versus real asset issue. And I've referenced this several times as we walk through the charts. The debt growth model is over. That means the long-term bull market in bonds is over, which is not to say if interest rates come down in a recession, we won't get a bounce in the bond market. But you have a real credit issue, which is you have a lot more debt than you have real assets and collateral backing it. And you have the fundamental economics of just about every enterprise hit by the rising costs of energy, and in some places hit by the rising cost of labor. For, you know, when you're going to poison the population, you're going to shrink your labor supply. You know, that's just pure math. One of the things that raises is a collateral issue. I did a review in October of a book called Collateral Markets and Financial Plumbing. This was recommended by a wonderful ally. It's a economist at the IMF who argues that there's been a real shrinkage in the quality of collateral. I pointed out, I disagree with his analysis. I think the problem is, since the financial crisis, the reason the liquidity and the rehypothecation of collateral has shrunk by about 30%+ is because financial institutions don't trust each other, and there's so much collateral fraud. And, you know, it's remarkable that the market works as well as it does. But there's no doubt there's a search for collateral in the universe. It's one of the reasons, it wouldn't surprise me, we're going to space. Farrell and I talk about it a lot, but the financial markets are like heat-seeking missiles looking for more collateral. There's no doubt about it. And I think it's one of the reasons you're seeing so much real estate securitize. Anyway, but I would not recommend the book to you unless you're a pretty sophisticated financial person who's very interested in these topics. But I would recommend the review, because it talks about the problem being You know, the problem isn't that we lack collateral. The problem is we have so much financial fraud, you know, with phony collateral bopping around the planet. Of course, the big one being the U.S. Treasury market, because we've issued lots and lots of treasuries while we've shifted the money out of the government that has issued that debt. So there's a serious collateral issue there. The crypto op, everybody has heard plenty about what's happened with FTX. In 2017, I published an interview with Harry Blaser called The Bitcoin Op. You can find it in the library. And let me just, if you go down to the, after you're logged in, you just go down to the search box for the library. So anything that's before 2017 is in the library. And let's see. Yeah, here we go. 2017, so it's the homepage. Bitcoin, the op. So, you know, at the time I said crypto was an op, and I still say it's an op. Not to say that a crypto doesn't have the possibility of turning into a legitimate, useful digital currency. And, you know, the problem right now is that the regulatory structure has not been sort of introduced and it's not matured. And I did a 3-hour interview with Mercola this year. So, yeah, so if you just put in Bitcoin at the search box, you can pull up my interview with Dr. Mercola and Alex Svetsky. So the Bitcoin op and the crypto op are far from over. And I think FTX will be used as a great excuse to come up with a regulatory structure and promote, you know, sort of the central banks doing their form of digital this and that. But expect a lot more about the crypto op in 2023. One of the big trends is the continued deterioration in the federal credit. I put up a blast from the past this week that included an article that Carolyn Betts and I wrote last year or two ago about caveat emptor, why investors need to do due diligence on U.S. Treasury and related securities. I'm constantly asked whether people should buy a U.S. Treasury, and particularly in the inflation series, because it's had such a high interest rate. And I always say, you know, if you trust the U.S. government to keep its word and you want to finance what the U.S. government is doing with its money, then, you know, then you might want to do it. And I leave it at that. Skidmore, and I describe in the commentary to this blast for the past, Skidmore has just done an analysis that shows that the U.S. will need 50% of our tax and other revenues in 2023 to pay the interest on the outstanding debt. Now, if interest rates rise by just another point, it's going to be 55%. If they rise by another 2 points, it's going to be 65%. So the we're in a debt spiral. And it's not surprising that the U.S. dollar has fallen a lot in the last month. So the credit issues are very serious, and that's why if you're sitting on a large pile of Treasury securities, I strongly recommend you read caveat emptor, particularly if you're an institutional investor. So there are very serious credit issues, and that's translating into all the different moves to tyranny that we're watching. And so it's one of the reasons Carolyn and I wrote the taxation wrap-up. You cannot deal with the tyranny issues without dealing with the financial issues. They're two sides to the same coin. So we've put a lot of links to the things we've written in the past about the missing money. And but if you're concerned with the treasuries in your pension fund, your retirement fund, your IRA, your 401k, I would certainly read caveat emptor. The next thing I want to talk about is what I call the growing tear in the fabric of the markets. It started with various U.S. sanctions, most recently the Russian sanctions, But we also see an incredible tear in the financial markets and the equity markets between China and the United States, with China threatening to delist various companies and the Chinese moving away from a trade model to a national security model, and in the process wrecking havoc with, you know, in the Hong Kong and Shanghai markets as well. So we're watching a move away from a capitalist model to a, it's, some call it a technocracy. I just call it a fascist technocratic model. And it's really causing havoc with wealth in the equity markets. If you look at what's happening with the Chinese, the riots in China, that is basically the cities and many of the populations who've prospered in the trade model getting angry at the national security guys because they're basically destroying the goose that laid the golden egg. And it's the same in China as it is in the G7. So it's going on in both places. One of the ones I want to focus on today is what I call the abrogation of shareholder rights, commensurate with the pandemic. Now, it had been going on for a while. We are watching more and more corporations no longer represent the best interests of the shareholders, but use the corporation for a political agenda or an agenda dictated under, you know, some would say military law. And the corporation, the board of directors and the CEO basically abrogating shareholder rights, just abrogating all obligations to shareholder. One of the examples I use is Qantas. Qantas was a company that I had just tremendous respect for. They had the best safety record of any airline in the world, just incredible, incredible safety record. And if you ever flew Qantas, you were just always amazed at the excellence of their culture, their service, their attitude. It's just a super, super company. And I always just deep appreciation and admiration for Qantas. To watch Qantas mandate injections for their pilots that could threaten the pilot safety and the passenger safety in a way that completely could destroy shareholder value, you just cannot believe it's going on. What would get a board of directors and a management to basically trash every best interest of their shareholders in this way? It's one of the reasons the different presentations that says military law was behind this makes a lot of sense, because if you look at the destruction of shareholder value, you know, some people would argue you can make up for it with government subsidies and contracts, but that's not going to work in the long run. You need real economic value to make things work. So Qantas is one example, but we have a new example, Disney. And I'm going to show some charts that I showed in Money and Markets today. If you look at Disney stock, this is the first chart as a five-year stock chart for Disney. And what you can see is we hit a low coming into the pandemic, the stock rose. And you wouldn't think that would be happening. Yes, a lot of people are streaming, but they're also not going to Disney World. But sure enough, the stock has fallen out of bed and is almost back to the low at the beginning of the pandemic. We saw the CEO replaced by the former CEO, and a real effort to change things. Now, whether it will work or not is another question, because their streaming service, which lost $800 million last year, is now, well, it lost $1.4 million this year. Maybe it lost $600 million last year, and it's now lost $1.4 million. So big losses last year, big losses this year. This is a comparison of Disney with... we have Disney down here. So Disney's, the stock's down 40% this year compared to the S&P. When I did this chart, the S&P was down 19%. Now it's down 14%. But as you can see, Disney is significantly underperforming the market. Now let's take a look at why. These are three charts from a recent study by Statista about Disney. 47% of Disney users, this is their 10 most important issues facing the United States. Now, remember, Disney users, and this is their thoughts about the most important issues. What they come up with is a list of issues that affects everybody. Forget what your social issues or your political issues are. These are issues that we all share. 100% of us share a problem with rising prices, inflation, and the cost of living, the economic situation, health and social security, education, poverty, crime. Well, climate change, you know, that's another discussion. Unemployment, housing. So all of these are bread and butter, you know, a chicken in every pot kind of issue, and they impact 100% of the people. So there's no division for social issues. There's no division here for all sorts of divide and conquer issues. This is just straight out bread and butter issues that we're all struggling with. That's what Disney people care about. Now, if you look at politically, 23% or so say that they're left. Say about 30% say they're center, and about 30 to 35% say that they're conservative. And then you got 13 to 17% saying, you know, so we've got brand users, category users, all respondents. But essentially, the vast majority, because my bet is those who don't want to respond are probably center or right. The vast majority of the market is not left-wing, right? They're not. Now, 14% of Disney users consider themselves part of the LGBT community. And we can guess so again, brand users, category users, all respondents. So in all respondents, it's 11%. So 11% of all respondents, which probably are part of this 21%, is my guess. You know, the vast majority are not interested in these or focused on these issues. Or, you know, so if you look at the woke agenda, because Disney has been outrageously promoting LGBTQ in a way that's unbelievably aggressive, and numerous woke issues. Now, what that means is they've been proposing issues that are not of interest to the majority of their users and are not among the top 10 issues for essentially all of their users. I mean, so it's not surprising that you have the market walking away from their streaming service and their streaming service losing $1.4 billion. Now, what that says is, you know, the management and the board have been using Disney to promote an ideology that is of no interest, essentially, to the majority of the audience, and which is causing a huge amount of the audience to just walk away. You know, they're going elsewhere. They're going to Netflix. They're going to new streaming services. They're going to HBO. They're going to Paramount. They're going wherever they're going, but they're going away from Disney. Now, once again, we see a board and a management dedicated to a political agenda or an ideology which is contradictory to the best interests of shareholders, which means investors' money is being used to promote an agenda that's going to lose investors' money. And you think, what is going on here? You know, this is not a company, it's an invasion that's destroying investors' wealth. I mean, I have to tell you, this is one of the worst abrogations of shareholder rights I have ever seen. It's unbelievable. And the unfortunate thing is we're seeing it again and again and again. It's heartbreaking. You know, my other company does a screen, and it's heartbreaking because I've had to throw so many companies out of the screen. And, you know, when you have to throw someone like Qantas out, you just want to cry because it takes... When you look at what it takes to build a company as excellent as Qantas was, you know, that is decades and decades and hundreds of thousands of people over time working to do that. You know, you're talking about what to me is sort of a living ecosystem, You know, it's like burning a forest down. Why would you do it? It's, you know, it's part of the what I'm now calling the democide, but it's horrible to watch. I mean, it's horrible to watch innocent people killed, but it's also horrible to watch beautiful companies that create a lot of value and create a lot of employment, create a lot of jobs and do a lot of great products and services. It's horrible to watch something like that be destroyed. Okay, I want to talk about a new word that I've resisted, but now I'm starting to use it, and we're going to use it in the annual wrap-up. The word is democide, and it was coined by a political science, Rudolf Rummel, who I've just ordered his books. So let me just read from Wikipedia. The intentional killing of an unarmed or disarmed person by government agencies acting in their authoritative capacity and pursuant to government policy or high command. So there's no doubt that we are dealing with the COVID pandemic and the associated injections and various euthanasia efforts. We're dealing with a democide. And one of the reasons we're dealing with a democide is we're dealing with injections and other forms of poisoning that are clearly lowering fertility and the birth rate. And we can only look at sort of early numbers, but there is a significant rise in all-cause mortality. And there is significant or indication of significant drops in fertility and birth rates, it looks like, related to the injection. Now, that's the drop in fertility has been going on for a long time. So I don't mean to suggest that the great poisoning started with COVID. It didn't. It's been going on for a long time. There are serious questions here about how this is going to continue and roll out and what it means to operating a business and the price of labor and productivity in this environment, not to mention what it does to your consumer base. So there are very, very real questions, because it also means that there is a real breakdown in the rule of law. Now, we can see it everywhere and we're feeling it everywhere throughout our lives, but this is very, very significant. And so the question is, what is it going to mean to businesses? What is it going to mean to their consumer markets? What is it going to mean to their investors? What is it going to mean to their labor? And if you're running a company in the middle of this, it makes it harder and harder to function. So in the middle of this, we're focused, and I continue to focus on building wealth, because the only way, all solutions require the pie to get bigger. And if you understand what I understand about the economy, it is possible as an economic matter to make the pie much greater than it is. Now, if everybody is running around and behaving in demonic ways with demonic habits and trying to make money by stealing other people's pies, it's hard to, you know, to bake new pies. In the midst of that, I appreciate that. But my focus is on building the, you know, the kind of world I'd like to see. And that means we all have to be building pies. So in the second quarter 2022 wrap up, which was on gold and silver and their role in building family wealth, in that equity overview, so it's the last equity overview, I went through what we've been developing. I call it the Building Wealth Curriculum, which is a way of reorganizing the Solari Report content into a comprehensive and integrated way of approaching building wealth. And my focus is on financial wealth, but to build financial wealth, first and foremost, you've got to build living equity. So living equity is being healthy and having education and skills and all the things that then create the ability to create financial equity. I also believe in this environment, as risk is skyrocketing, you can't build financial equity and you can't build living equity unless you have really good risk management. You can't have good risk management unless you have a good map. So I go through in the last equity overview, so second quarter 2022 equity overview, I go through sort of an introduction to the integrated approach and the importance of risk management. Then I go into living equity and then financial equity. And we have just a wealth of links there. You'll see here, there's a PDF of the links for the different parts, and you've got a transcript as well. Where's the PDF for the, yeah, here under recent materials and links, it says Building Family Wealth, the Solari Approach to Personal and Financial Wealth. And what you'll see when it comes up is it's just links for all the different areas. You can see here. And it's a great way. Think of this as a buffet. Please don't feel overwhelmed by it. Just take a look at where you want to dive in and think of it like a buffet and take advantage of the different pieces. So again, meant to be comprehensive. Now I bring it up because we are, let me see if I can, in the third quarter, our theme is building wealth. And I'm going to be redoing that curriculum to make it more comprehensive and better. And so I hope by the end of December to have filled out the building wealth section. So right now we're in the equity overview. But again, and that will be sort of an upgrade of the curriculum. Now, my plan is for literally throughout 2023, we're going to be building it, filling it out, adding more, and continuing to grow it into a very comprehensive curriculum for building wealth. And I always tell people, I said, who say they want help with investment strategy, I keep saying, you don't need an investment strategy, you need a war strategy. And it's true. If you're facing a democide, you don't need an investment strategy. You need a way of going to war and hopefully coming out the other end alive. And that's my goal. I wanted to mention one of the things we do, and of course, we're in the section, what do I do? How do I build wealth? One of the things I recommend every year in the annual wrap-up, so we're looking at the annual wrap-up for last year. We had best books for 2022, and there are a lot of books in this section that are very good. So we have personal finance and development. A lot of great recommendations for books to help you build wealth. So personal finance and development, investment, then books on the global economy, geopolitics, on and on and on. So our picks for the best books in the different areas. And then we show you the book reviews that we've done in recent years. So in the annual wrap-up in January, we'll have a best books for 2023. Now, there's going to be a lot of carryover because a lot of the books that I find that are the best, you know, they just keep being the best. So if you look at the here in personal financial development, my guess is all of these books are going to be in the 2023. Certainly the investment are. I've never found books better than James Montier for the investment side. And of course, Benjamin Graham is really good, but, you know, can't put him in every year. Anyway, Montier, I love Montier, so those are going to be similar. Anyway, but there's a lot of great books to help you on the investment side listed in the best books. So our goal next year is to continue to build out the Building Wealth curriculum. And as I said, I hope to have the new Building Wealth section under here by the end of December. But we are now putting our news, trends, and stories in the quarterly wrap-ups and the annual wrap-up. We're putting them into a Building Wealth framework. And I'm going to keep doing that. And in the annual, we'll also do our scenario plans. So I'm looking at the scenario plans in last year's annual wrap-up. And I really recommend you spend some time with these. And we have a great Solari report called Scenario Thinking that teaches you how to use scenarios. In scenario planning, you have two axes. So we have two variables. And so in the last years for the scenarios to help you plan for 2020, 22, we had all-cause mortality on one axis, and then price inflation and shortages on the other. So the rise in all-cause mortality could be low and to high, and then price inflation and shortages could be low to high, and that creates sort of four different scenarios. So this year we're going to have the increase in democide, low and high, and we're going to have sovereignty, the push for sovereignty, low and high. And that'll create four scenarios. I really recommend that you take those scenarios and you think a lot about, okay, how can I be successful if the world goes, you know, if the death rate skyrockets, how can I be successful in the world? If the push for sovereignty is strong, how can I be successful in that? Anyway, so when the scenarios come out in the annual wrap, I would suggest that you spend some time with them and do some planning. Because I think if you look at what you do, I think of my assets as something like players I put out on the chessboard. And my goal is, you know, that my players get to the other side. You want to make sure that you don't, you know, you've got assets that are going to help you through that scenario. Because remember, our goal in a war strategy is you come out the other side alive with some assets. Ideally, more assets than you started, but you know, if not, with some assets, because that's part of what it takes to stay alive. Anyway, so what I wanted to do, if you look at all the links I gave you for the other equity overviews, particularly the second quarter, last quarter's equity overview, I go a lot through the different markets and different, you know, sort of different things to do. I don't want to repeat all of that, but I want to go through what I do just to give you a sense. My problem with telling you what you should do is everybody's different. Everybody's situation is unique. And I find it very difficult to give generic advice. In fact, I don't recommend taking generic advice because your situation is different. And any advice about what you do should organize around having a very good understanding and literacy about your situation and your needs and the particulars of what makes the most sense for you. But let me walk you through what I do. I have deposits at the bank, both personally and professionally. For obvious reasons, I have a great bank. I love my bank. I feel completely confident in my bank. Is there risk of leaving money at a bank? Sure. But if you have a good bank, I feel my bank's arguably one of the highest capitalized banks in America, let alone probably even the world, and has had great board and great management. So I'm quite confident in my bank. You can keep all your money at home. At the same time, I would tell you over many, many years, I've had more clients and subscribers lose, you know, gold and silver and cash because they had it at home and the plumber took it. I have no debt. I've spent a lot of money in the last couple of years paying off debt. And this is an environment where I think if you can get rid of your debt, it's a good thing to have. Debt just limits your flexibility. And so I like having no debt. I have plenty of cash, but I have it spread around. Like a squirrel, I got cash here, I got cash there, I got cash all over the place. I do as much non-perishable stockpiling as possible. So the only reason I haven't stockpiled more non-perishables is I don't have a lot of space. So, but if I had more space, I'd be stockpiling even more. Home and home improvements, I keep steadily investing money in making sure, you know, I have a tiny country house in Tennessee, but I keep investing more money in doing various things that improve and upgrade it. And this year, after Titus gave his little speech on legal tender, I said, that's it. I don't want to worry about this anymore. And I paid off my mortgage, even though I had a great mortgage lender. I love my mortgage lender, Farm Credit. I had a great mortgage lender, but I just decided I'm not going to worry about this anymore. Let's get rid of all the debt. So I paid off the mortgage. And the interest rate was relatively low, but I just said, let's get it paid off. Precious metals, I like gold and silver and core position. Now, we at Soleri, we have Soleri coins that we use for promotion and gifts. So I can always buy more Soleri coins. And that's what I do every time the silver takes a dive. I order more Soleri coins. I continue to buy every month on a savings program more equities. But I buy equities that are screened. It's one of the advantages of doing a screen. I can have a lot of confidence in, you know, that I'm buying companies that are very productive, not companies that are behaving in the way that Disney's management and board behave. So I'm looking for companies that respect shareholders' rights. I also only invest in this current environment in equity that's hedged. So I don't mean a hedge fund. I mean hedged with puts. We did in the third quarter 2021 equity overview, we did an interview with Jason Wirth on what hedged equity is and how it works. And I would recommend that to you. If you're nervous about your market positions, you might want to talk to your asset manager, financial planner, or, you know, whoever you're using on using hedges to protect yourself from a big down. Of course, my big investment is investing in Soleri, and I'm constantly reinvesting in Soleri. So, and a lot of that is in people and in content. That, you know, as money comes in, we invest it on building the network. If you look at my long-term dream of what I'd love to do, I would love to build a university. I would love to build a global network that is literally its own internal financial network that really helps and protects the people in it. So what I'm looking to build is an intelligence network, you know, but it's really about a network of people who are building the kind of future and civilization we want to live in. And so I can think of millions of reinvestment opportunities ad infinitum for Soleri. I'm just going to keep building. Part of that is what I call the people bank. So I invest in people. And of course, if you're running a company like Soleri, you can do that. But we don't just invest in people who work for Soleri. We invest in all sorts of people in the new media who I think are terrific. When I want to see an article written, I'll just ask some of our key allies in the new media, can I sponsor you doing this research and writing this article? And if you publish it, so we've done this with Corey Lynn of Corey Diggs many times, you know, we'll sponsor it. She'll research and write it. She publishes it on her site and our site. And it's free to republish all around the internet because that's our way of getting the things written that we think need to be written. And we think we're much stronger if we're supporting lots of allies doing it than trying to control it ourselves. So we want the knowledge out there. We want the information out there. And we want to support the best in the new media to do it. And so a lot of our sponsorships or donations go out to other websites. We think we need to be many, many stars across the universe and with no sort of center if we're going to be effective. So I'm big on donations and helping to signal, you know, here are people we should support, here are things we want to see happen. We publish in our wrap-up our donations every quarter. I'm always telling people, if you don't have an army, you're not going to have assets. What's the point of having assets if you don't finance your army? So if you look at our donations and a lot of the gifting that Soleri does, so we always send Pete Kennedy to the Rogue food conferences, and he sells the wrap-ups, and that money goes to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. Or in Knoxville, we sold wrap-ups and the money went to Farm to Consumer Legal Defense and Weston Price. We just went to the Forum for Democracy Congress here in the Netherlands, and they have a great Renaissance Institute that's building schools in the Netherlands. And we sold about 350 wrap-ups and the funds went to the Renaissance Institute. So we are always trying to finance our army, but we're also always trying to support our allies who are doing great things. I just did an interview with Senator Frank Nicely of Tennessee on the importance of a sovereign state bank and bullion depository. That's one of many examples of trying to support people who are doing great things in this world. So if you look at a lot of the heroes on the Salier Report, a lot of the people we interview, what we're trying to do is we're finding people who do great things, and we're trying to, you know, we're trying to invest in sort of adding their effort to what I would call the People Bank. In terms of relationships, one of the most important things you can all do in this environment, because enforcement is being weaponized, for God's sakes, get a good CPA. And if you need a good financial planner, get a good financial planner. Now, a lot of people ask me for recommendations, and we don't make them. For a CPA, you really want somebody who's an expert in your jurisdiction. The reason I like a good CPA or tax preparer is, as long as you're getting great advice on what you ought to be doing, then you can prove that your intent was, you know, if there's any mistakes on your taxes, you can prove that your intent was fine. Nobody can prove intent against you if you've got a good preparer. And they're doing, you know, they're advising you on what you should and should not do. When people ask me for a financial planner, I point to the fact that we've had several financial planners on the equity overviews, and one of them is going to be joining me again for the annual wrap-up equity overview in January. It's funny, back to the commentary for the equity overview in Rambus Churchology. This is where you're going to be able to find all the links that I've referred to or showed you this evening. Our theme today on Money and Markets with John Titus was Scrooge and Coming Clean, sort of the message of the Christmas Carol. And I said that Augustine Carstens and Bo Lee, two guys who've been really promoting CBDC, are the ghosts of Christmas future. It's Scrooge seeing the horrible ghosts that, you know, gets him to come clean and turn from being miserly to being generous and loving. If you look at what people like Bo Lee, who's the deputy IMF chief, who's big on CBDCs and is highlighted in John's new video, if you look at what he and Carstens have in store for us, what the central bankers have in store for us, you know, that's not a Christmas we want in our future. So if ever there was a time to come clean, now is it. There's one subscriber who keeps emailing me and saying, how dare you promote switching to cash or growing your own food in the face of, you know, immigrant and Chinese invasions and directed energy weapons and all the things that are arrayed to, you know, basically destroy us. And I don't mean to underestimate the dangers and the risks that we face. I think 2023 is going to be a very high friction year. But what I have to say is, over the long run, freedom has always won, and I'm planning on winning again. I don't underestimate how many people the directed energy weapons and the various invasions can kill. But I also think whenever you have times of this kind of great friction and great change, you have great opportunity. And that's why our intention always has to be to build wealth, because one of the things that causes the dangers and the risks is the shrinking of wealth. And so solutions always require building wealth. And if you go back through history in times of great danger and rising risks, the people who pulled it out were always the ones who wanted to build wealth, and build wealth in the truest sense, not just financial wealth. I mean, you know, people wealth. And, you know, of course, our greatest wealth is our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. So that's why I think it's incredibly important to invest and finance the kind of world we want to live in, and not fall prey to thinking in fear. So I'm not saying don't duck, But I'm saying turtle forward and let's finance and invest the kind of world we want to live in. One of the things I do, as I said, my other company does a screen, and it gives me a chance to constantly look at companies all over the world that are making great products and services, including a lot of new products and services that are absolutely fantastic. So in the midst of all this horrible going on, while you see some people leading an effort to destroy and kill, you see other people starting and building companies that just do great things and are beautifully governed and well-managed. They're out there. And so there's plenty of great people fighting to build the kind of world that you and I want to live in. And that's, to me, that's what we have to be. Anyway, so those are my thoughts. There is a wealth of information at all of these links in the prior equity overviews that can help you figure out what you should do. But again, this is an environment where I know what we'd all love to do is find a financial advisor who can tell us how to punch the slot machine and get three cherries with a whole bunch of money pouring out. But it's not that kind of environment. We're in an environment where it's not, you don't need an investment strategy, you need a war strategy. And the reality is in war, you know, you're going to put your players out on the chessboard and some of them are going to get shot. Some of them are going to get destroyed. Some of them are going to get killed. Now, if we win and we win, you know, the ability to support a world where there is rule of law, you know, then we can get to the other side and we can get to the other side with more assets than we have today. But it's going to be a war. It's going to be a food fight. And so get ready to rock and roll. And it's the kind of strategy where you have to take personal responsibility to understand what you own and why you own it, because you got to live with it and you got to not get shaken out of it. It's one I used to work with clients who'd never invested in precious metals. I'd spent a lot of time educating them so that if they bought and then, you know, the price took a nosedive, they didn't get scared and sell at the low. And you gotta know what you own and why you own it. And the nature of the environment is, you know, more and more we're gonna have to move to real assets. And so you gotta understand what you own. So you may own a stock, but you gotta understand what that stock represents in terms of a company that's doing real things with real people and real assets, and you have to have confidence in it. If you own a stock in a really great company, it doesn't bother you when it goes up and down because you know what you've got, and you understand the underlying value. So again, you gotta understand what you own and why you own it. You got to take responsibility and you have to understand how it relates to different strategies. So for example, your core position in precious metals, you hold for, you know, it's central bank insurance. It's not there to make you money. It's there to protect you in the worst case. It's nothing worse than spending a month teaching somebody what a core position in precious metals, they buy it, the price goes down and they're complaining that they haven't gotten a good return. It's like, wait a minute. Price will go back up. Stop worrying about it. But it's not there to make a dividend yield. It's there to protect you in the worst case. And I get back again to you got to know what you own and why you own it. Anyway, so I hope those resources are useful. If you have questions, please put them in to Ask Catherine. And I'd be delighted to answer them or roll them up into the fourth quarter annual equity overview and Rambus Chartology, which we'll be doing sometime towards the end of January. So say a month, month and a half. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, don't forget it's Christmas. Season has started. December 1st is when you're listening to this. We have Give the Gift. Your subscription comes with the ability to give a gift for Christmas to somebody who would enjoy a 2-month subscription that takes them through the annual wrap up and access to everything. They can download a year's worth of content if they want to, more than a year if they want to. And it's a great gift to give somebody who'd like to try the Solari Report. And we also have holiday packages. So subscribers can buy packages for holiday gifts at, there's some nice discounts. So holiday packages, give the gift. A lot more is going to be rolling out during Christmas, and including every week starting this Friday with the best of the Sillier Report. We'll have a different collection of the best of the special reports, the best of the weekly interviews, the best of the wrap-ups. It'll include all the wrap-ups. So some great content rolling out. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Christmas season. And I hope you have a wonderful time developing your investment strategy, aka war strategy. Anyway, good luck and good night. Thank you.